Good afternoon, everyone. This is Eddie Huff, and you're listening to Fresh Black Coffee. This is a special edition of Fresh Black Coffee. I've got Congressman Mark Wayne Mullen, who's smiling over here. He's surrounded by fresh black coffee here.
Like, why have we got all these bags of coffee? And then he said it, I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense now. I'm tracking.
actually, it's supposed to mean this show is supposed to be the fresh black coffee to wake you up. It's going to wake everyone up.
Yeah, but I follow that one, too. But the bags of coffee puts a different vibe out sometimes. Yeah. But it does wake you up. I don't really drink coffee, though, but I get it. My workout's my cup of coffee in the morning.
Okay, well, there you go.
I can't imagine if I had coffee, if I had caffeine, how much more energy I would have.
Oh, yeah,
My wife would be throwing me out of the house.
Yeah. In fact, you know, it's funny because I think I dropped some coffee by your house. I mean, not your house, your office, yeah, one time for you, right. and they didn't say anything, but now I get it that you don't drink coffee, so.
I actually did drink coffee. I drank coffee for years. In fact, I started drinking coffee when I was a little bitty boy because in a dairy barn, it's what kept our hands warm. And so I'd keep my hands warm, and then you just start kind of, you know, drinking coffee. At 4 o'clock in the morning, when you're having to be at the barn at 4 o'clock in the morning to milk, anything is good. But when Jim got hurt, January 17th of 2020, you know, my son got a real bad dramatic brain injury.
Yeah, yeah.
They said he couldn't have any more stimulus. And they said, I mean, no caffeine. He could never drink alcohol, really? Drugs, which I'm good with all that.
Yeah, yeah.
But they said it'd be a very heavy effect type of brain injury. He'd have high highs and low lows. And here I was drinking, I don't know how many cups of coffee. I mean, I didn't put sweetener in it. I loved black coffee, just black coffee.
Right.
And I never liked Starbucks coffee. I always thought it was bitter, but I liked good coffee. And when he got injured, I was like, well, I can't have coffee. So it took me probably about 2 months to wean myself off of it.
Wow.
And once I got off of it, huge difference.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I agree. It does make a difference.
I still like coffee, but I drink 100% decaffeinated black coffee throughout the day. But it's very hard to find 100%, not decaf, 100% uncaffeinated.
Uncaffeinated, right. Un versus D.
Yeah.
You know, what I found about that, it's interesting you say that because I have migraines.
You're right.
And caffeine is my trigger. Chocolate and coffee, which for somebody that loves, I'm a chocoholic.
Right.
And coffee is another thing I like. And so.
They both give you migraines?
Yes. See, not that day, the next day, the day I don't have it.
Yeah, well, now it does me too. So when I didn't have caffeine, I would get a migraine every day. That's
exactly.
Why I drink coffee all the time.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I finally got off it. I went like a week, and man, you talk about withdrawal.
Oh,
it's bad. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's like somebody shot me in the head.
Yeah.
So anyway, all of a sudden I start. But then after a while, I said, "Well, I have some decaf," and then all of a sudden I had a headache. And then I find out that decaf is not uncaffeinated.
Right.
It still has caffeine. Mark Wayne, I'm going to do something real quick. That mic is not picking you up enough, so I'm going to switch it out. I have that one right there. Dave, if you could grab that one, and we're going to unplug. Okay. Plug that and plug that one in.
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right.
There we go.
It's got power.
You good?
There we go. That's more.
Let me adjust this.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah. Now we're getting the full Mark Wayne.
Full Mark Wayne. So anyway, yeah. So there's only a few Keurigs that you can get that are uncaffeinated too, like Keurig just to cram it down because in the middle, like if I'm in DC, I want something hot, and so I'll take that cup of coffee uncaffeinated and Keurig. There's two. That's one is 99%. Decaffeinated, which I'll take that. And the other one's 100% decaffeinated, and the one that's 99 is the donut brand. And the one you can get 100% uncaffeinated is Dunkin' Donuts.
Wow, I never knew that. See, people, you watch and listen to Fresh Black Coffee, and you learn something new.
Yeah,
uncaffeinated coffee, not just decaf,
but
the
uncaffeinated beans or decaf uncaffeinated beans you can get. The only place I have ever been able to find them is Blue Mountain from Jamaica.
Ah, Okay, there we go.
And I actually shipped those in.
Well, thank you, Congressman Mark Wayne Mullen. Hey, Mark Wayne, I was telling Josh, I guess what he is your campaign manager.
Yeah, Josh Owens. Yes.
Josh Owens.
Yeah.
How we met, I think it's 12 years ago. The first time you ran was when? What was it?
First time 2000? I ran was 2011.
11. So, right. Yeah, we're talking 13 years ago.
Yeah,
then.
Right.
And, or 12 and a half at least. And down in Tahlequah, mm-hmm. which I think you were there today, right?
I was in, where have I been today? I have been,
where was I today?
I wasn't in Tahlequah speaking today. I drove through Tahlequah, but I have been to Fort Gibson, at meetings in Stillwell, our hometown, West Siloam, Broken Arrow, and then here, and then I'll end in Quetta tonight.
I see, man.
Yesterday I was in Oklahoma City. You want me to give me my schedule this week?
No, it's okay. We only have an hour.
It's crazy. I have been all over the place, but no. So it was Tahlequah at a, you were speaking, and I forget the name of the group at the time now. The Fishers, it was the Fishers that was put the group on. They're not around anymore that I know of. Or the Fish. Is either the Fish or Fishers. I can't remember. They'd moved in from California. And you were a guest speaker, and there's a lot of people there that night.
Yeah. And that's exactly, you remember, I was the guest speaker, which is, and that's how we met. And we hit it off, and Dwayne was there. Yep.
Dwayne Thompson.
Yeah. Dwayne Thompson, who became your...
Go-Brett for a while. He's a great guy.
Yeah. And so it was a good time. It's funny how you look back on those times, and they're really good memories, you know.
Right.
Because everything... I think what it is, there was like an innocence to it, kind of. You know what I mean?
It was. Yeah, I agree with you on that one.
And so, but those were the early days. And, but you know what I learned in through that time, I think you and I kind of hit it off. We didn't know each other at all. Never met each other. But what I think really, I learned to respect you. I learned two things. One, how down to earth you are. And you still are, and you've never changed. You're still down to earth. I mean, you know, I call you, you actually pick up the phone, you call me, I don't have to go through a bunch of people. You come to our little humble studio.
Surrounded by coffee.
Yeah, talking about coffee, yeah. Yeah, you know, and something people don't know, I hope you don't mind me sharing, but Mark Wayne has supported... I run a little ministry to orphans in Africa, in Uganda. And Mark Wayne, for the last, I don't know how many years, it's been a long time, has supported these kids in Africa. You know, it's stuff that you don't know, people don't know. And I only share it because I think it needs to be known. But anyway, it's these little things that I really look up to people that make a man or a woman. You know, I don't want to get into
it. Right.
But no, it's what builds character. And so those are the things that, like I said, it's what really, really does that. But anyway.
Wife that keeps you humble.
Yeah. And the other thing, I remember back in, I think it was in the 2000, what was it, 16 or 18 race, the one that had me quit at KFAQ.
It was 16. Probably.
Yeah. Mark Wayne called me and asked me to interview he and his wife, Christy. And so I decided, okay, I'll do the interview. And I remember asking you, is there anything you want me to ask or not ask? Because usually, you know, there are areas you don't want to step on mines or things that you don't want to get the person in trouble since you're being asked to do the interview. And I remember you saying, nope, whatever you want, just ask me. I said, oh, okay. And I thought, wow, this is good. You know, this is amazing that you would trust me that much that I could ask you anything. And I think I did ask you a couple of questions, like the one, are you blaming God on your decision? You know, that was the one question about it and so forth. But these are the things I think over the years that have really spoken to me and my wife as well about you as a man and your wife and your family, and of course, just seeing your family and all the things that you've gone through. And I remember how, going back to the KFAQ thing, they wouldn't let me come in. I don't know if you even know this story.
I remember, yeah, what you talked about.
Yeah, right? They wouldn't let me come in the day that you just got attacked. It was like a four-hour show, and 3.5 hours was attack Mark Wayne while he's not there, and they gave you 30 minutes to come in and defend yourself. Yeah. And they wouldn't even let me come in. And I would have told them that I told you, don't do it. You know, don't do it. And they didn't even give me a chance to do that. So, but in the end, I'm glad because you and Pat were able to reconcile and you became good friends. And Jaron and all of those guys. It just shows, again, the type of person you are. So
still friends with Jaron. And, you know, I was honored to even be able to speak at Pat's celebration of life. It was just it was surreal to really, I mean, this guy that we went to battle.
Oh yeah.
And, and then to be able to ask to speak to him at his celebration of life was just, you've seen a guy that went full circle and so did I. And it was amazing. But only the Lord does stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
Only the Lord can put stuff and heal wounds like that. And it even when you think it's too deep, if you are just able to humble yourself, I mean, really, and it's tough. If we're able to just humble ourselves in front of the Lord, then He can put everything else in place.
Exactly, exactly. And I was so happy with that because I know there was that real tension there for a while between you guys, and just to see the healing and the coming together, it was really good. So, anyway, hey, so tell the people, if you would, and me, what have you learned in these past 12 years in office now? It's been about 12 years. What have you learned, good and bad, about being in national office?
So, I've learned that anybody that gets into this field, if they become lost in themselves, if you recognize that someone's becoming a little arrogant, which, you know, I started being a little arrogant. I used to be a wrestler and a fighter. You know, that's kind of your walk, right? But I'm just saying this should be the most humbling thing you've ever done, because I had to learn how to take a deep breath. I mean, really take a deep breath, because the expectations of what people think you can get done, and in reality, you can't, because you're only one. And it takes 218 to get anything across the floor, so you got to get 217 people to agree with you. That's tough. And so you have to learn to breathe, and you have to learn to attack it in a different way. And then I had to learn how to not take things so personal. I tell people, before politics, there was very few men that I ever argued with. I just saw no point in it. I'm not one to really argue. I grew up with a really bad speech impediment. And so I just kind of developed this mentality of that I'm not going to argue with you, because I'm probably going to lose because my words aren't going to come out right. So I'm going to hit you. And so I wasn't really good at this. Uh-huh. And so when I get confronted, I would get overly aggressive. I've always had this mentality that I'm never going to be the first one to make you feel uncomfortable. But if you make me feel uncomfortable, I'll kick your front door in. I'm going to step right into it. So I was really combative. And the Lord really went to work with me. And I know we're talking political, but before you can get political, you got to get your core right. You got to be centered. Because politics, if you're not centered, politics will literally destroy your life to a point to where you lose reality and what is real and what isn't. You get this false perception about yourself, because everybody does call you by your title, and they will answer your call, and they treat you like you're somebody, but you're really not. And the proof of that is when you leave office, no one remembers your name. And that you just, or if you die, you'll get 60 seconds of silence, and then they're going to be talking about who's replacing you. Mm. That's the reality of it. So you have to learn to just kind of not take that stuff. But for me, I had to have a learning curve, just like you should in any office or any job you're in. You should get better as it goes. And so opposition, when they'd come after you, which you're always doing it, I'm not supposed to have a group of individuals protesting me. And actually, it's from the transgender community, supposed to be protesting me at my church this Sunday. True story. I live out in the country, and I go to kind of a cowboy country church. That'd be interesting. Yeah. what happens? But I don't take, I used to just bother me, right? And it doesn't bother me because the Lord really got hold of me one day about love. I never really told anybody I loved them. I just didn't. I told my wife, I told my kids, but other than that, I didn't. In fact, I thought love was overused. Everybody's like, love you, brother. Love you too, brother. But that's not love, but that actually is love. If you're showing respect to the individual, that's you're showing them love. And so I started getting up every morning. I had a situation. I had a situation, several years ago when I said, that's bullcrap. You don't pay my salary. I pay enough in taxes to pay my own salary. Which what I said technically is true because our companies pay a lot in taxes, right?
I remember when you said that and got in a bunch of trouble.
I got in a lot of trouble for it. And so what I said was technically true, and the person that was doing that wasn't from Oklahoma. She'd been following me around for 3 days. She's from Texas. But I let my anger get ahead of me, and what I said may have been technically true, but it wasn't right. It wasn't right because I am working for the people, and I was getting frustrated with it. I was getting mad because everywhere I was going, I was getting protested and people were coming after my family and I had to change my phone number because they released my phone number and they released my home address and my kids couldn't even go to the mail and we couldn't go out to eat because they had this thing called Cover Blue and they would just swarm the restaurant and every time I'd walk out, I'd have death threats literally in my gas tank or on my car or all kinds of stuff. And I was just getting frustrated with it, right? And the Lord worked on me one day and he said, love the people, love the call. I mean, he didn't like audibly say it, but it came in my spirit. Love the people, love the call. And I talk to people about that. Anybody that you work for me, if you talk to Josh, you talk to anybody that works for my office, they'll say, what does Mark Wayne say to himself every day? And you can walk up to anybody that works for me, not in the companies, but I'm talking about in the official office, and you say, ask them, what does Mark Wayne say to himself every morning? And they'll say, love the people, love the call. Because I remind myself that this is an honor. I get to serve people. And when people are mad at me, they're not mad at me. They're mad at the government because the government has failed them. The government has failed a lot of us. They have abused their power. Government has. Doesn't mean that I have, but I'm their outlet. And so I'll literally tell them when they come up to me and I'll pat them on the arm or pat them on the shoulder and say, you need a hug. And they'll like, look at me like this. But I've learned how to love the people.
Right.
And that's been a huge learning curve. But then I also learned this government can hurt you bad. This government, people in politics, they'll hurt you a lot to gain themselves a little. I'm a pretty loyal guy. I mean, I'm pretty loyal. When you're my friend, you're my friend. And I'll go down with you and I'll go up with you too. I'm going to help you up. And if you get in a fight, I promise you, I will not walk away from you. I'm going to be right there with you. And so politics is weird because they pretend like they can be your friends, but they'll hurt you a lot the first opportunity to gain themselves a little notoriety because it's become their identity. Now, I tell people if you're ever going to change Washington, D.C., you're going to start changing the resume you send there. Because if you send people with only political experience and political background, then you're going to get someone making political decisions. But in the real world, we don't work that way. Mm-hmm. We work with relationships. And so I've had to adjust to that and learn that our fight isn't getting any better when we fight with each other. Who loses is the people. And since we've been fighting with each other sometimes, we've taken our eye off the ball until they finally unmask themselves. And what I mean by that is we were fighting within the Republican Party with ourselves. We're trying this purity test, you know, rhino, not rhino, you're this, you're that, you're whatever. And we're pointing fingers at each other. But at the same time, we had these Democrats working behind us that was trying to figure out how to become a socialist country. Now they've completely taken their mask off. So, I mean, they've taken their mask off. They're socialists now. They're not hiding it. They're not disguising it. Their policies say it. They are saying it. They call themselves Socialist Democrat Party, the Socialist Democrat Party. Their platform's embracing socialism. So they've unmasked it. And so now we've got to learn how to take that fight to them and not fight with each other. We've got to quit pointing arrows at each other. And so I've learned how to refocus who the real problem is. It's not the people that are frustrated at me. My job is to restore their faith back in some part of the government, but then get them readdressed to, hey, this country's great. You can't address me that way because you have the right to, but in the socialist world, you won't be able to. So let's make sure we keep this freedom of speech going.
You know, that reminds me, I remember you used to always say in negotiating, you did the 70-30 rule. If you can get 70%, then you're willing to Right. Give 30 if you can get the 70.
Right.
Do you still hold to that?
Absolutely. What I say is I want 110% going every meeting, right. Every negotiation. In business, all I've done is negotiated since I was 20 years old, right? So in business, I'd always want 110%. But I would be willing to negotiate to 70 and I walk away at 69. But the most important thing to negotiation isn't just to know your position. The most important thing in any negotiations is know where that other person's position is. You got to know what's a deadly set, what they won't come off of, and what they're soft on. And then you got to see why they're coming from that perspective. Look at it from their perspective. And if you can get that down, then you'll be successful in almost every single negotiation deal you go to. Because you know their position just as good as they do. And then you know yours. And most people won't do their homework and figure that out. But yes, doing something's better than doing nothing. And we're about ready to go into a political year, right? And which we're already there, but we're about ready to go into a season to where the Republicans are going to be in control of the Congress. We're going to win the House and we're going to win the Senate. We're going to do it in November. The American people woke up. As I said, the Democrats have unmasked themselves. The independents and even a lot of Democrats are saying, we're not socialist. What you guys have done is running our country. So the American people, the great thing is they woke up. However, we still have a guy in the White House that we got to work with. Like it or not, we're legislators, and there's not one single piece of legislation that we can get into law if we can't get it signed by the president. It doesn't work.
Well, how do you do that? I mean, it doesn't seem like he's pretty amicable to doing it.
You're right. So we have two options here. We can either, one, hold our nose and work with a guy that we, in some cases, may not even get 70%. Just, we got to have our expectations different. So my 70% when Donald Trump's in office is completely different with my 70% when Obama was in office. And the same thing here with Biden being in office. And who knows who's even running the White House? I don't know. I mean, I'm not trying to make a slate at it. I'm just saying something's not right there with Biden right now. But we have an option. Either we try to get something moving in our direction, or if we do nothing, then what's going to happen is it's going to allow him. Remember what Obama used to say? If I'll call on Congress to act, if not, I got a pen and piece of paper. That means he can do 100% of what he wants at this point with an executive order. With an executive order. So if we don't do something, then we're going to allow him to be able to rule by executive orders, and executive orders do become law until that executive order is unturned. So we are going into a 2-year period with high expectations, but we better understand what that high expectation, high mark actually is, and can we achieve that? That's a challenge for us as a party moving forward and looking at what we're going to be able to do.
So there's nothing that Congress, between your House and Senate, can do to overturn the executive orders or to stop those? I mean, I guess if you get to 66
if we get to senators, 2/3, right.
Right. Then you could do it. But I mean, in the absence of that, there's nothing.
It takes law to overturn an executive order or executive order to overturn an executive order. So if we don't have 2/3 majority in the House and the Senate, which we won't, then we can't override his veto. So he can veto every piece of legislation we have there that we send to him. He can veto it. And then we don't have the ability to override it. The other option that we have, because it takes law to do that, it takes either executive order overturn executive order or law, which is legislation, for us to turn it over with his signature. Or we take it to court and we find out if the court aligns with him. That's a long process, though, right? Yeah. That can take a long time. And then you got to show harm. And so to show harm, or otherwise it'll be kicked out. So if we can't show harm, reason why we're bringing this suit, because essentially we got to sue at that point, then it can be easily just turned away, which happens a lot of times when we bring this up and ask the court. But then we're putting more, what we're doing then is we're essentially putting more power in the court systems that we've learned we can't trust. You can't trust them. We have judges that are making political decisions. All I want you to do is make a constitutional decision. I don't need your opinion. And you got appointed to a bench. You didn't run for this bench. You didn't run because you're a political affiliation. You got appointed because supposedly you're supposed to be the best. But we see political appointees like the lady that just got on there who couldn't define what a woman is. I mean, that's the craziest thing you've ever seen in your life, right?
Yeah.
So we have a huge challenge. I mean, we've got a huge challenge in our head and in the ahead of us. But do you know what? Not to sidebar here, but do you know why we have executive orders that are the law of the land today? Why we have more presidents now that are changing law and making law through executive orders, which is essentially bypassing legislators to begin with?
No.
Executive orders are never supposed to be used this way. They were never designed this way. You can't find that anywhere. And they never really got abused in this manner until Obama was in office. The reason why they got abused is because you go back and you look at a Chevron decision. It was a Chevron versus the EPA. It's called the Chevron decision. The court made a final ruling on it in 2005. And what they essentially said, what was brought up was the Chevron was asking the courts is if Congress and the agency in charge of executing the legislation that they passed are in difference of interpretation, who has the final say? Does Congress have the final say because they're the ones that initiated the bill? Or does the EPA have the final say because they're making the rulemaking of it? And the court said that Congress essentially delegated their powers to the agency and by default made them the expert. Therefore, they had the final say. After that, it started making and Bush was in office at the time, right? So Bush really never took advantage of it. But Obama, when he came into office, his office looked at this and says, hold on a second, we can take advantage of this. We can make law now. We can go back and go to the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act for these environmentalists that was passed in the 70s, and we can change that law through an executive order because our agency head is we appointed. And so they're considered the expert, and we can bypass Congress. And so one thing we're doing in our office right now, I have legal hired right now that we're trying to go back through and see how can we tighten back that law? How can we redo the Chevron decision where the law stays where it's supposed to do with the people, the people's house? That's Congress. That's why it's for the people and by the people. And through executive order, it's not. The executive order, it's one person making the decision. And so that was never what our founding fathers wanted. They never wanted one class, one person ruling. That's why they set up the legislative branch to begin with, because we all have one voice and one vote. And so we've totally went wrong, and we've got to bring that back, or otherwise we're going to continue down this path.
Wow, man. Yeah, thank you for that, because I don't think most people know.
I didn't.
Really, yeah.
I didn't have a clue. I had to go and study it.
Yeah, we hear this stuff all the time, executive order, this, but nobody really knows how it came into being and so forth. Let's back up a minute, because you were in the news a lot during the Afghanistan withdrawal, and I won't ask you to go in because I know there's some covert stuff and secret stuff that you don't want to get into, but that was a pretty weird deal. What we do know is that it was totally mishandled by the administration. We should have pulled everybody out before we took our troops and everything out. We left all that equipment. Where do you think we stand, or where does that stand right now, Afghanistan in the aftermath, the country, and what has that led to?
A disaster. On the world stage, an absolute disaster. The way the Biden administration handled the withdrawal was... I'm on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, so we deal with this stuff all the time, and we're privy to know what the Trump administration, they initiated the withdrawal, right? But when Biden got into office, the outgoing administration tried to show them the plan that they had on how to withdraw out of Afghanistan. They wanted nothing to do with it. They literally threw it in the trash, not figuratively. Literally threw it in the trash. We literally had to shred it. And at the time, we were going to keep Bagram Air Force Base open, which is we were going to always keep it open.
Right.
And we were going to help protect Kabul and use Bagram to have overwatch in that region, because it's still hot. Now, we were just going to quit going out and doing work outside of there. We were just going to simply use it as a city locked down by itself. so what happened was is that they started withdrawing, and they had no plan. I mean, they let Bagram get overran, and then they went and hit in a non-defensible airport at Hechkaya. And we had a situation in our hands where a lot of Americans were being left. And you had this administration that was going out there saying that every American that wants out can get out. You just got to come to the airport. The problem with getting to the airport is there was three checkpoints set out 100 meters out. And each checkpoint would cost you $500 to $1,000 per person to go through, depending on who you were. If you were a marrying age, meaning a young female, or fighting age, a young male, which, by the way, marrying age and fighting age means can you reach over and touch your ear? Go across and touch your ear. That's how they measured your age. And then you're $1,000 a piece. If you're younger or older, then you're $500 a piece. If you're a male, an adult male, not elderly, but adult male, then you're $1,000 a piece if you could even get through. They're probably going to beat the thunder out of you. And if you're a female of value, even though you may be married, they'd use you as a comfort woman, then you're $1,000. So you had three of them you had to go through. So most people didn't have the money to be able to go through. That's why the Germans, the French, and the Brits were going out and getting their people. For some reason, our administration, Secretary Blinken, General Donahue, who was running the bay or the airport, and General McKenzie, who was back in the States, and Milley, who was here, wasn't allowing our troops to go outside the wire to go get the Americans. And so they were going to get left behind. And we got drug into it because we got asked to do something from something that I used to do in my past. We got asked to go, and how do you say no? Problem is I didn't think the biggest hindrance we were going to have was our administration. I never thought they would be the biggest fight. Now, at the end of the day, we ended up getting over 300 Americans out. Now, the news doesn't report that. But the team that I was blessed to be able to work with, we got over 300 Americans out, but we didn't get everybody out. We lost some. We lost some kids. We lost some Americans. When we didn't get refugees and SIVs, these were just AMSETs, American citizens. We got over 300 Americans out after they left Kabul, after they pulled out. This wasn't at the time. This was after they left. We worked all the way up until December 5th. And it put a huge black eye on us because we were having to work with these countries like Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Pakistan to get people out. We were having to go over land to be able to get them out. Very dangerous situations we were finding ourselves in. And the biggest problem we had when we would try working with these other countries is why? This was a question, I'm paraphrasing it to you. But this is a question, why would we work with you? Before you guys came into the country, we were fighting these dudes too. But at that time, they just had donkeys and AKs rusted shut. Now they have armored vehicles, protective vests, night vision, and all the latest equipment. At the top of their game, they just had Toyota Tacomas they're running around. Right. They're better armed and better equipped now because you guys left them that way. And you're wanting us to help you get your people out? What about our people that's going to be stuck here fighting them? How do you explain that? Yeah. I mean, someone that's trying to get, and I'm like, look, I get it. I mean, how do you say this? Look, I get it. I understand you have the right to be mad. I'm like, yeah, I'm sorry about that. But I still need to get these guys out. Can you help me? Can you help me? I know you don't owe us anything. Can you help me? Hey, that's a tough situation. And the reason why, and I will believe this, the reason why that we have the battle and the fighting going on right now, and the Ukrainian army is losing 100 men a day, is because the weakness that Biden and his administration portrayed over Afghanistan. And do you know, to this day, not one single person has been held accountable. Not one person has been held accountable in this administration for that disaster of withdrawal and Americans' lives. Not just the 13 soldiers that were lost and the 13 Marines that were lost. I meant it's the other Americans that were lost and some of them that are probably still losing their lives today. And no one's been held accountable. In fact, General Donahue, who oversaw that disastrous withdrawal that was inside Hechkaya, do you know where he's at right now? He's overseeing the situation in Europe.
Yeah.
You got to be kidding me.
You know, you said something that just really perked my ears up. You said you're losing 100 people a day in Ukraine.
That's what President Zelensky said. They were losing 100 Ukrainian soldiers a day.
See, we're not hearing that because all we're hearing is about how well the Ukrainians are doing and how many of the Russians are losing. But we're not hearing anything about the Ukrainians losing. And it makes me think that
the publicity, the propaganda, if you will, that is being fed to our media is trying to prop it up, to feed into it, to keep this thing going.
Do you know this fighting in Ukraine could be over right now? This war, not one single person should be dying in this fight right now. Not one. It's because of President Biden's trip to Europe is the reason why that's happening. Now, everything I'm telling you right now is open source. So I'm not.
You're preaching to the choir, Mark. I'm preaching to the choir.
I'm telling you, but I'm just saying that nothing I'm telling you is classified. Yeah, you can go do the research on this. So we were trying to help negotiate a peace deal, not just simply a ceasefire, but end the war. And the Putin wanted four things. He wanted Ukraine to become a neutral state. And if you remember back then, if you're paying attention to news, you heard President Zelensky immediately come out and say, "We'll be a neutral state." You remember him saying that? "We'll be a neutral state." Neutral state. Neutral state means he's not going to be affiliated with NATO or anything like that. No allies. Number two, he wanted Crimea to be recognized as a Russian state. Now, Zelensky didn't went out and said that they were going to allow that to happen, but what Zelensky did say is that we would allow all the Russian sympathizers, all the loyalists to leave. We will give you safe passage to a safe area. He didn't say Crimea, but that was doable. Number three, they wanted to control the ports. Wasn't going to happen. Number four, they wanted Ukrainian army to lay down all their arms and basically neutralize. Wasn't going to happen. But we were going to be able to do the Crimea, possibly. I think it was going to happen, and definitely become a neutral state. That was enough for Putin to get out of this. He wanted out. What happened in the middle of this negotiations? I'm talking about we're probably within a week to have this thing done. Biden decides to take a trip to Europe, and he's talking to the 82nd Airborne. Now, I understand the 82nd Airborne is like the Spartans in Europe. The 82nd Airborne, because of their valor in World War II, has this mythical, legendary, this mythical, legendary just aura about them in Europe that people respect. There's a reason why the 82nd Airborne is there. It's a mind thing. And you have a guy that's done nothing in his life except been in office for 40 years. And he's talking to the 82nd Airborne. And he's trying to tell them, these battle-hardened individuals, what they're going to see when they get downrange. What they're going to see when they get into Ukraine. First of all, he has no business saying that to anybody because he has no clue. No clue. What a joke. No clue. Don't sit there and tell me what it's like unless you've been there. Don't tell me. And he's sitting there and he's saying this stuff. And we had never discussed. We knew in the summer of last year that this was probably going to happen. We knew in October, within a 48-hour window, when it was going to happen. We've never discussed sending troops in Ukraine. Ever. Never been even a scenario where that would happen. We have never discussed it. And then the President of the United States is talking to these guys that they're going to send troops into Ukraine. Not been a conversation. And then the next day, he goes out there, which we got that tamper down. Believe us, our phones are ringing. We got that tamper down. We're good. That's a mistake. He made a mistake. You know, Joe, I misspoke. The next day, he's talking to NATO and says Putin can't stay in power. Once again, never discussed. But what Putin heard is we're going to put the 82nd Ukraine on his border and he can't stay in power. Negotiations ended. The next thing you seen was Zelensky come to the mic and he says, "Diplomacy is lost. I need weapons." You remember him coming out and saying that? Diplomacy hasn't worked. I need weapons. The war is happening today because we have an incompetent president that can't even put a sentence together and he's representing the United States. Why is he even out there? He is truly, truly a national security risk. Truly a national security risk. And people know that. You can't help but look at him and hear him talk. And I'm not saying this in a negative way going out to our president. I respect that office. But that person there that's representing us has no business making these kind of decisions. It's horrifying to me.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I agree. And you know, it's funny because some of the things you said is what I've been saying from the beginning. I think really, ultimately in the beginning, all Putin really wanted was to make sure he had that unfettered access to the Black Sea, to the Mediterranean. in other words, he didn't want NATO there on that coast of the Black Sea in that area because, you know, it borders Russia, that eastern part mm-hmm. that borders Russia, and then he didn't want NATO controlling that sea route to the Mediterranean. That's very important. It'd be like us with Cuba. We don't want the Russians in Cuba and or in Venezuela, wherever, you know, on bordering our country. So I think that's the primary, the number one important thing. And then there's all these other issues. So
well, you're partially right. But remember, Russia has never fully recovered from the collapse of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. They never fully recovered. Right. And so Russia's ruble, which is their dollar, was in junk status. And as big as Russia is, their economy was only the size of Italy. So because of Joe Biden's disastrous policy decision saying we're going to go to zero fossil fuels, even though we became one of the largest LNG exports overnight, essentially, once we started sending them out, we had 33 countries that were depending on us for LNG exports. To have a strong and reliable economy, you got to have a strong and affordable energy. Because if you show me a country that can't keep the lights on, I'll show you a third world country. So the backbone of every economy is strong, reliable, and affordable energy. Period. Ukraine, the nation of Ukraine, they had the second largest pipeline, natural gas pipeline, going into Europe next to Russia. Because of our policies that we had and we're going to come off the market, Putin took this as an opportunity to say, hey, not only can I take over the energy of Ukraine, but once I take over the energy of Ukraine, I'm supplying 40% of Europe's energy right now. They are supplying 25%. I'm going to immediately go to 65%, and I'm probably going to be able to push that up to 80% with my new pipeline coming in. And so I'm going to control Europe's economy. He'll have the power to turn on and off that economy anytime. So he becomes the most important man in that region. And then then he takes control of the ports. And not only does he control the water, but he controls the food supply, 25% of the food supply of that country. Ukraine is more important in that region than people realize.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was a calculated decision that he made because of a weak leader we have in the White House.
That breadbasket over there in the Donbass in the
right.
Eastern area. Yeah. Yeah, it's a mess. It's definitely, man. Hey, you probably remember one of my favorite questions is, what do you say to people who say, anyway,
yes.
It is, are you now a career politician? That's the new one. Yeah. That's the latest one. You've been there 12 years now. Now you're going into the Senate for another 6 years. How would you answer that?
You know, you only become a career politician when it becomes your career. It's not my career.
It's not your career.
It's not my
income.
You're
still a young guy. Yeah. You're still young.
Well, it's not my income. It's not the source of my income.
But you might not. So you still do own Mullen Plumbing.
So we own a percentage of it. We sold a big chunk of a lot of seven companies. We have a lot of other things other than just Mullen. Mm-hmm. And we had a company that came in and purchased us and purchased a lot of other service companies in town too. And so we still own a large percentage of it, but not the majority of it anymore. But we still have other companies. I mean, a lot of companies that people didn't realize that we own, we still own them. We still have a lot of employees. We did have two restaurants. We just sold a restaurant a couple weeks ago. So we just have one left. But we have, you know, multifamily housing. We have single family housing. We have land holding companies. We still have a construction crew, a ranch. You know, we still have a lot of stuff that we're involved in, and that's our source of income. It's what we do. I get to do this. It's an honor, truly an honor to serve, but it's not my way of life. And so I've been in office, but it is being a careerist. It's when it becomes when you're a politician, it's because that's your job. You know, that's your sole source of income. It's what you do. That means that you can't afford to make a hard decision and fire yourself.
You believe it's your calling. At this point, you believe that this is your calling.
I believe this is something that the Lord has asked me and has gave me the opportunity to do. And it's up to me to be a good steward of it, because it can be left, it can be pulled away from me at any given time.
You know, I've been thinking about it that, you know, I mean, like people ask me, do I believe in term limits? And I believe we have term limits, and it's when the people decide they don't want you to be their elected official. The Constitution has term limits, right. And they're called elections, right? But to say you want somebody in for 3 terms as a representative, 2 terms as a senator, something like that, you're just getting your feet wet. I mean, the learning curve to me, like the things you've been telling us here today, you didn't
have a clue.
Exactly. Mm-mm. The first 2 years, I mean, my goodness, you're probably just figuring out where everything is in the building.
It took me 3 years to figure that out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so in that fourth year, you're already running for the next election, yeah. Right? So, to me, that's why I have an issue with that personally, everyone. We've got to rethink this. And that's why, you know, when Jim Bridenstine, all of a sudden, remorseful. Now we're losing Jim, or so all the people who love Jim Bridenstine, all of a sudden he's gone because he term limited himself. Now, what do you do? Now, fortunately, Kevin Hearn's in and they're happy with Kevin, but you never know what you're going to get. You don't always end up with that. So, but, and now the step to Senate is it just knowing what you know from the platform that you did have. This just takes you another step, a little deeper, a little more powerful position to be able to do even more, I think. Yeah. And so explain, I mean, the difference between being in the House and in the Senate.
Well, first of all, if you're going to have term limits, you got to understand that we got to term limit everybody. It's got to apply to everybody because seniority does matter. And the most powerful people in Washington, D.C. are the ones that's been there the longest because they have the most important positions.
That's good.
So if you're going to do it, apply it to everyone. And I think there is. I mean, 40 years in office, you've lost touch of reality. Yeah. To some degree, unless you're someone that's coming home every day and you're still working here. Now, I think you can do it right. I think you can come back and forth in office and you can spend time. You can spend time in D.C. and still be here, but a lot of these guys go to D.C. and they stay. I think Jim Inhofe is a prime example for this, right? Jim Inhofe, he came home every single weekend. He lived at the lake and he lived here too, and he never really became what I'd consider institutionalized. A lot of people do. So there's a point that I think sometimes, you know, maybe you should step aside. But it's got to apply to everybody. For me, I feel like I want to be productive. And the moment I'm not productive, then I want to be out of there because it's not my livelihood and it's definitely not my identity. And so when this seat came up, my wife asked me, she said, well, where can you make the biggest difference? If you're going to be away from us and the kids, where can you make the biggest difference? And Eddie, without hesitation, I said, the Senate, like that, without question. Without question, if we're going to be there, we want to make a difference. So if we're going to do that, then let's go where we can make the biggest difference. Where can we influence Washington, D.C. the best? We don't need Washington, D.C. coming here and influencing us. We need to be taking Oklahoma values, and we need to be instilling them in Washington, D.C.
What will be the biggest difference between your role in the Senate and in
the House? So in the House, we basically just legislate. That's all we do. We don't have any really oversight. Now, we used to have oversight of agencies, but we really don't have oversight of the agencies anymore. Not since the Chevron decision. We don't really have any oversight of them. Since we don't do a line item appropriations, we do bundling, and we give them a chunk of money now. Instead of appropriating that money, we give them the money, and then who gets to decide how that money is being spent is the executive branch. And the executive branch is the one who points the person to be over that. Who confirms that individual is the Senate. And that's what's affecting us more today than anything. All the regulations we're dealing with is coming from these agencies that are getting orders from Washington, D.C., and who appoints them, who confirms them, is the Senate. And so the Senate has more oversight of these agencies than anybody else. And let me tell you, if you're not living underneath those regulations, if you're not in business today, if you're not dealing with those regulations today, if you don't have kids in school today, which I have six of them, then don't tell me you know what it's like. You're not dealing with it. You're complaining about it, but you're not dealing with it. And you'll never find someone that's going to have more passion to fight for us than someone with firsthand knowledge than someone with secondhand knowledge. And so when we said that's where the fight is, that is where the fight. That's the biggest difference is now we have direct oversight because that person can also have to come back to the Senate and we can recall them. Well, great. Now, it takes all of us to do that. And it takes the president to help, but we can sure put a lot of pressure on them. We can sure do it if they're not doing their job. And right now, I don't think anyone's doing their job.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which brings me to this. Do you have any kind of relationship or good relationship with the governor?
Yeah, I got a good, pretty, I mean, real good. We talk, we probably talk at least once a week, if not more than that.
What is the role?
Especially now, I guess, probably with this, with the campaign going on, we probably talk more than that, actually.
What is, if any, the role of the Senate in the whole McGirt decision, if any? And you're Cherokee, mess. Right?
Yeah, I'm Cherokee.
You're right. Cherokee. So you would definitely have some say in this. What do you think? What is your position on the whole McGirt decision?
I don't necessarily have a position on it. Okay. Yes, I'm Cherokee, but the McGirt affects everybody. It's not, I'm getting elected by the state of Oklahoma, So Cherokee or not, I'm getting elected by the state of Oklahoma. And who's losing right now is the state because we have tribes that aren't exactly on the same page. You have two tribes over here, and you got three tribes over here. You have the governor that's not getting along with the tribes, and I don't really know where John O'Connor is. I'm not saying this in a bad way. I'm just saying I don't really know where our AG is on this because him and I haven't had a real in-depth conversation about it. But the state is who has responsibility on this more than we do. The Congress is never going to act unless we get a direction from the state. In the meantime, because of the bickering that's going on between everybody, we are losing out in the state. It's affecting all of us. I live in McGirt country. I've always have. I've never lived any place else but where I live, and it's all around me. And people, and I travel out to Western Oklahoma, and I talk to some sheriffs out there, and I say, well, what about, how does McGirt affect you? Well, it really doesn't affect us over here. You talk to any sheriff on this side of the state, and they'll say, oh, my Lord, let me tell you. You talk to any judge, you talk to any police chief, you talk to anybody, and they'll tell you. And you talk to me personally. I mean, we've had stuff stolen, and no one will prosecute the person. My neighbor down the road just the other day, I mean, when I say down the road, he touches our property, but he's a mile down the road, and he got his house ransacked. And they wouldn't even do a report on it. Nobody's even looking for it because it's that situation we find ourselves in between. And Eddie, we are all losing and no one's coming to the table. And the governor will say, well, I got an open door. And the tribes will say, I have an open door. But who's going to reach out and say, okay, let's put to bed some of these bad feelings and let's look forward. Because I know the tribes want what's best for Oklahoma. And I know the governor wants best for Oklahoma. There's no doubt because every tribal member, guess what, is also a citizen of Oklahoma too. And they're living in this same situation we're in. So they want this problem resolved too. But who's going to reach out first? I feel like, honestly, and this isn't anything against the governor at all, because I got great respect for him. But the tribes had a court ruling that ruled with them at this point. And they're also sovereign. And people say, well, they shouldn't be sovereign. Well, go back to the treaties. You may like it or not like it, but the treaties made them a sovereign nation with no expiration. It was a federal government. It was our federal government signed that. None of us was around during this time. Okay, this was a treaty with no expiration. They called them a sovereign nation, so therefore they are a sovereign nation, because otherwise if we don't respect that, then we're not as good as our word, and as a person you're not as good as your word. So you either respect your word or you don't, and that's what the treaty was. And so with the ruling that's taken place, I would hope to see when this election is over. There's a lot of bad feelings. We see what's happening to the governor. We see these ads going after the governor. We see this stuff. So there's a lot of bad feelings around there. I would hope that the governor at some point will say, hold on, let's hit the reset button. Not the Staples Easy button. Let's hit the reset button. And let's come in and sit down and talk and see where we can get to a neutral spot. Not my idea, not your idea, but how do we set this negotiation that really is understanding everybody's going to give a little, but everybody can also get a little too. What are we going to do? And if they come out of that meeting and they say, Congress, this is what we need you to do, then you're going to see the Oklahoma delegation go and do it. But if the Oklahoma delegation is going to have to sit there and go, I stand with this person, or I stand with this person, I stand with this person, probably not going to happen, because Congress at that point isn't going to do anything too. Because remember, this is special to Oklahoma. So if the Oklahoma delegation isn't speaking in one voice, then there's no way Congress itself will act.
Yeah, yeah. No, I understand. That makes sense. But it seems like somewhere there should have to be a common sense solution.
You would think. Yeah. You're talking politics. So, Eddie, just go ahead. That's like an oxymoron. You would think, yeah.
Okay. Hey, no, I agree. Mark Wayne, hey, listen, I think, yeah, you've got things to do, I know, and I thank you for this time. Man, there's so much more, but
We'll come back. Okay, good.
But I do want to get to your kids. They're growing like weeds. I mean, it's crazy. I remember the little bitty kid, and now they're big.
We first started this journey, I only had three.
Yeah.
Six now.
I wanted to say this. So now you have a daughter. My wife was telling me she's really impressed by this latest commercial where you have your daughter wrestling.
Right.
In addition to your son, yes, he has a daughter wrestling. If she's not wrestling,
I'll earn the ears. I can say it the way I want to. Yeah, wrestling.
Wrestling. But anyway, so it's interesting because, you know, sometimes we get accused. I do too. Of being chauvinistic or anti-woman or whatever, you know, and because I'm very much opposed to a lot of the equal rights thing. Do you remember the ERA type of stuff? And it was funny because I remember the Father of the Bride, the Steve Martin movie. You remember that?
Yes.
Okay. And I remember where his daughter went to, he paid for her to go to law school. He wants to be a lawyer, her to be a lawyer, and he's all prepared for it. And then she wants to get married, you know, and everything. And he's all frustrated because he paid for his. And I remember the line, I will never forget it because it rung true with me. And he says, what is the deal? Am I the only feminist in this family? And because I felt the same way, I want my daughter to, she went to Pepperdine University and graduated summa cum laude and all of this stuff. And I was all excited. And then, you know, she wants to take care of babies, you know. And I'm thinking, what is wrong? I had her whole career path, you know.
You had it all planned.
Yeah, I had it all planned. And yet, you know, I'm seen a lot of times by a lot of women, I think. In fact, if you were on Facebook, you'd have seen this argument, big thing I had about nursing and the whole baby formula thing. I was viciously attacked as this man who did not care about women. But what I'm getting at in a roundabout way is your ad speaks to two things, that you believe in womanhood enough and in women being able to do anything they want to do to have your daughter wrestle, but at the same time that she should be wrestling against other girls.
Right.
Right? Other women. It's unfair to have her wrestling against your son's competitors.
Right.
Right? And so this is what, for some reason, this other side does not understand this. They would accuse you somehow of being a bigot or insensitive or a sexist or something because you think girls should wrestle girls, girls should run against girls, girls should play tennis against whatever, and guys against guys. And all we're saying is we want girls to be able to do any and everything that they can do.
Right.
But they should be able to do it as girls or as women.
Yeah.
And not have to compete with a testosterone filled male.
Right. You know, and this is what I was saying is my daughters, because I had three, and in my family we have six kids, three boys, three girls. And in my family, you have one choice about wrestling. I say you have two, but you really have one. You can wrestle and like it and wrestle and not like it, so you choose your attitude. Because wrestling is a sport that teaches character. If done right, it teaches character.
It's tough.
And I've been blessed to have some really good athletes. And Lara, as a seventh grader, won state competing against eighth and ninth grade girls. And she had a huge bracket, and she walked through the bracket. And then, you know, I've got good athlete boys too, and they win state too. And so I've made the point that this is Lara, my daughter, and this is my son, Jace. And the point I was making, and this is what I said, is that Lara, our girls, in fact, I said our girls can compete with anybody as long as it's on a level playing field, a fair playing field. But you take somebody like Leah Thompson, who the year before was competing as a collegiate athlete that wasn't even competitive as a collegiate athlete, as a male.
Right.
Who decided to say I was a woman and identify as a woman, but if you look at Leah Thompson, Leah Thompson does not look like a female. I mean, her body or his body or her body, I'm not trying to be funny here, I'm just saying I don't know, I'm really... It looked like a male body to me, so you can't say that transition didn't happen. They did that Leah didn't decide to become a female until way later in their life.
Well, I mean, one rule, a simple rule, would be if you have ever competed as a male, you don't get to compete against girls. I mean, that's a simple rule.
Transgender athletes want to compete, then make a transgender league. I'm not saying don't compete. I'm just saying compete right. against peers.
Right.
Because what you had on that stage with Leah Thompson was arguably the fastest woman in that division, who was a silver medalist in the Olympics that just the last time the Olympics were up, meaning that she was one of the fastest females in that sport at the time. And Leah Thompson, her best time was like in the 130th as a male. And just blew away the competition. That's bad because it costs a championship and other females under Title IX the opportunity to compete and be in on the podium. Well, that's bad because there's a championship lost. But now let's take a competitive sport, a combative sport like wrestling. And you put a male out there competing against my daughter. Especially a little bit later in life, but now that she's at the age that they're all going through puberty, someone's going to get hurt. And it's going to get hurt, really upset, and could be career ending. And it's nonsense. It's ridiculous. This isn't even political correctness. This is just common sense, people. And so call it the way that it is. Either you are or you're not for our daughters. It's that simple.
Yeah.
And listen, I'm not against somebody deciding to go do whatever. If that's what you want to do, I don't understand it. It doesn't mean I don't love you. It doesn't mean I won't pray for you. It doesn't mean any of that stuff. My feelings towards you doesn't change. But that doesn't mean that you should just be able to go there and take advantage of the situation now just because you want to identify. That just no sense to that. No sense at all. Right.
No, I totally agree. But like I said, to me, a simple solution is here's a girl or whatever that competed as a male.
Yes.
Collegiately. NCAA.
Yes.
A year before.
Wasn't competitive, but yes,
competed. And then all of a sudden switches over the next year. No, if you've competed, I mean, that would be a rule. For example, if you, I remember... If you played Olympic skier, what was his name, from Colorado? He was the mogul.
Are they all from Colorado? I don't know. Salt Lake City or Colorado?
He was
an
Olympic skier, and he couldn't ski in the Olympics because he played football. He was signed a pro deal to play football, so he could no longer ski. Well, football and skiing have nothing to do with each other. But to me, it was male skiing, male football, whatever. But you can be a girl, a guy competing as a guy, and then all of a sudden you switch and compete against girls. Oh, no problem here. I mean, to me, the rules are not consistent. They don't have a consistency because of the politics. Again, it's back to politics. It's politically correct and not being sensitive enough to the situation. Yeah. And I think that's the real thing. So
I'd probably go a little bit further. If you're born a male, you're born a male. If you're born a female, you're born a female. And wow. and that is that simple. It has, because your body type and your structure are still different. Yeah. It doesn't change. Now, as I said, if the transgender athlete wants to compete, then start a transgender league.
Yeah.
That is simple. But I think you're going to find is there are not enough of them out there. Right, to even have right, their own league.
Right.
But no true. One forced you to transition. You decided yourself that you wanted to transition. That doesn't give you the right to go in there and steal a spot from a true female. That doesn't work that way.
Very much. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for correcting me. I was trying to find some middle ground. I was trying to do a 70-30 here.
This one isn't 70-30 with me. This is black and white. This is even.
It's cool to see your kids wrestling and your daughter, and I can see where they get it from, that tenaciousness and all. Hey, Mark Wayne, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us, and I appreciate it a
absolutely
lot.
I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, and good luck, and tell Christy hello, and we'll look forward to
it. You need to work with getting you some uncaffeinated coffee.
Yeah, I got to find out where we get to some caffeinated. I didn't know there was such an thing. I just thought you had two choices, decaf and calf. Did you ever hear Pat and I, we talked about Cappy Luwak? Cappy Luwak. Uh-uh. It's they feed it to these cats in Africa, and I think Ethiopia, and the cats eat it, they digest it, and then they poop it out, and then they take those beans.
Yeah, no, not me, man. I'm good.
It costs before inflation, it was like $200 a pound. Yeah, no. I mean, it was very high.
It's like caviar. I don't like that stuff either.
It's caffeinated plus.
Nope.
Mark Wayne, thank you again. And so, hey, everybody, that's going to do it for us here. And we'll see you. This was a special edition, so we'll still do our Saturday show with David. God bless. Take care of everyone.
Of the consequences he might face.